Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Latino Vote Podcast. This is a proof of life that Chuck Rocha and Mike Madrid actually made it through election night last night. We are recording this the day after the election, even though you're listening to this on Friday morning. Kind of like they say on the NPR podcast, some things may change by the time that you hear this recording, so don't hold us accountable when we pontificate about what's actually going to happen a day and a half later. Mike Madrid, how are you this morning?
I am alive and kicking, which gives me hope that even as an older man, I am still able to recover in relatively good time from election nights, especially really fascinating election nights like we saw Tuesday night, last night. Lots to cover, parsing through this Latino data again, with so much still outstanding in the Southwest United States. There's going to be a lot of changes, but there's enough data, I think, to have a really good discussion on a number of different fronts about what's going on with the Latino vote. So looking forward to getting into this one with you, Chuck.
Ooh, I'm taking off. I wore a flannel shirt. It's a little chilly. And in Mike's honor,
yeah,
I wore my black Mike Madrid tuxedo today.
You got the Mike
Madrid. Can't see at home.
I didn't wear my tuxedo today. I gotta get back into my more formal attire now that we're in post-election season. I got to start dressing up again, get my black t-shirt going.
So I think what we do, Mike, and you tell me if you have a better idea, but I think what we do is we talk through what happened last night by category. And I think today we'll talk through the Senate races first and what stood out to me, and then I want to hear what stood out to you. And then we'll go to the governor's races and talk about what we're seeing and what happened with Democrats and Republicans in the governor's races. Mm-hmm. And then it's going to take us a long time because there's a lot of them, and a lot of them aren't called yet. But in the House of Representatives, what happened in the Congress? Mm-hmm. So we're going to concentrate on those three chambers today. Stay with us. We're going to go through a lot of stuff. But look, if I was to give you, before we talk about the Senate, the Chuck Rocha analogy of what I think happened from the Democratic side last night, and then I want to get Mike's reaction, then we'll just dive into the races because I want to hear his, like, what he's saying to reporters this morning and others is, look, there's a couple things, and I'm not going to speak for Mike. Let me tell you the way I feel as a partisan Democrat is that there was no red wave. There was just no red wave last night, and Democrats overperformed what Chuck Rocha thought they would do. And I'm going to be the first one on this podcast to say I was wrong about a few races. I end up with my total number in the Senate being dead on. I said it would be even, or we'd be up one in the Senate. And all depending on what's going to happen in Arizona, Nevada, we're going to be right there. But last night was a big lesson. People are going to say that Democrats had this big night. Well, Democrats had a good night. Republicans had a bad night, but not a horrible night. I think that people want to run to one side or the other. What you need to realize in almost all the congressional seats that we were working in last night, and again, Democrats overperformed. All my partisan Democratic friends, I'm saying that up front, but I'm also saying that they just met expectations on the Democratic performance for most of these seats. Most of the seats we were competing in last night were D+2, D+3, D+5, D+6 that Republicans had us talked into, we're going to win all of those. Well, guess what? Democrats just met their expectation in a seat that was D+5 and performed at about that level in most of them. So guess what? We overperformed expectations. So that was brilliant messaging. So last night, and I don't want to go on and on about this because I want to give Mike a time to talk. I would just say there was no red wave. Democrats performed better than what we had given them credit for. And we'll talk in detail about race by race. Mike, how did you take it?
I think you said it exactly right. Look, shockingly, the polling may have been entirely accurate or very close. There's a couple of anomalies. DeSantis blew the doors off of it in Florida, but Florida's increasingly isolated from the rest of the trends of the rest of the country. And Democrats had, look, historically, the Democrats had a very good night. And that, I think people were looking for this, you know, loss of democracy, end of the world, wrap it up America, move out of country kind of night, which the historical trend lines would suggest was very much in the workings for Republicans when all of the fundamentals were working against them. The Democrats held their own, and that's a good night. It's in terms of the actual math, both sides fought to a draw, but the environment was such that this should not have been a fight to a draw. It should have been a significant Republican pickup.
That's
year.
The most important thing, Mike, right there, is that what we're saying is when uninflation is at this rate, when we have all gasoline at a certain price, like people aren't realizing that we ain't supposed to even be in this ballgame.
Right.
Democrats should have got their ass handed to them last night. So I love that part. Go ahead. Sorry, Mike.
No, that's exactly right. And I think that's essentially what I'm saying. I think that's what you're saying is you got to look at it that way in terms of the actual balance of power. I mean, it is fascinating. I think I was right on the Senate. It's going to be plus or minus one, which is, that's pretty damn accurate. The House, I probably overestimated Republican strength by 6, 7, 8, 9 seats. Okay, that's fine. Then the Latino vote, I think I was wrong about the Latino vote. We'll talk about this. I thought it would revert back to a historical trend line that would look more like a 2018 number. It is clear from the exit data and from early precinct data that is not what happened. The baseline Republican vote for Hispanics is at 40%, which is shocking. In this year where a lot of things reverted back to the Democrats, Latinos stayed at their 2020 numbers. It's just undeniable now. It's part of the narrative. Will the Democrats either acknowledge it or adjust to it? Do they feel that they need to? I don't know. I mean, they may be doing so well now with white suburban college-educated women. That may be their future. And just say, let the Latino vote go. Let's double down here with what worked. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, I think that this vote, the Latino voters, district by district, I think there was a performance, overperformance in some areas, underperformance. Let's talk through them before we keep on going. We're going to talk about the U.S. Senate. As it stands, as we're recording this podcast right now, the big, big shocker of the night for the pundits was they have called Pennsylvania for the Democrats. That is a flip from Republicans to Democrats. That gives Democrats some room to breathe. We can go into detail about Pennsylvania. There's some information on Pennsylvania I've kept from you, the listeners, because I couldn't talk about it till we got out of that. But let's recap everything so you know as of this morning that Georgia is too close to call, could be in a runoff situation there. Wisconsin, too close to call, but the Republicans are ahead by a good bit in Wisconsin. But interestingly, we'll get to this when we talk about the governors. The Democratic governor's race in Wisconsin has already been called. Evers performed better than he did 4 years ago, which is crazy sauce. And you know what happened in Wisconsin? A lot of young people voted, but let me keep going. Also, too close to call in Arizona, too close to call in Nevada. Probably by the time you hear this on Friday morning, one of those will probably have called, if not both of those. And let me just say that right now, Arizona, the Democrats are ahead by about 100,000 votes in the Senate race. And in the governor's race, we're ahead by about 30,000. There's a problem there. We'll get to that when we talk about the governors. And in Nevada, a state that me and Mike Madrid have spent a lot of time talking about, Cortez Mastos is behind. And she's behind by, I think the last time I checked here, let me pull it up here on the big board behind me like Steve Kornacki would do. She's down at least, let me see, Nevada right here, about 25,000 votes. But all the votes that came in on Election Day, vote by mail, the ones that were dropped off at drop boxes, my sources in Nevada tell me, Mike Madrid, and I'll stop and let you give us some thoughts here, and I'll go into the start with Nevada, is that my folks on the ground say that all the Election Day has been counted, and that's all heavy Republican. And if you followed Ralston last night, he was talking about how Republicans were overperforming on Election Day. That was, in fact, true. But the outstanding vote is the vote that was in the mail, that's postmarked by Election Day, and that was dropped off yesterday at drop boxes. So the argument can be made on both sides, and I think it's anybody's ballgame. What do you think about the Senate map, Mike?
Look, I think, and again, Nevada is going to be the interesting one. By the time people are listening to this, we will probably know a lot more. As I understand it, the vote count will proceed on Thursday. And we will know probably within 72 hours from them, which means over the weekend, we'll know who won the Senate seat in Nevada. I'm feeling more bullish for Cortez Masto than I was even 24 hours ago, certainly more than 72 hours ago. There's a big gap to be made up. But if the Culinary Union is to be believed, they've got the votes out there. They believe they've did a big enough push to get a lot of those voters to vote. Again, the big storyline coming out of Nevada will be what was the Latino margin, and did the Culinary Union convert a lot of Latino Day of voters? We are a notoriously late deciding vote. We are a notoriously Election Day voter. If they moved those voters tactically to the ballot box, kudos on them. There's a lot to be learned tactically about the Latino vote because nobody has ever done that in a really meaningful way before. And so that's something we're going to have to learn as professionals. Pennsylvania, where I want to hear about your work there. You did some phenomenal stuff this cycle, Chuck, in a way that is going to redefine, I think, the Latino vote in some of these Rust Belt Northeastern states where this vote is relatively new, especially for old war horses like you and I. The fact that we called a race in Pennsylvania for a Democrat on election night is very significant. You can't discount that. I always believed Pennsylvania was in a fundamentally, you know, leftward position. I think Pennsylvania is more of a Democratic state than people give it credit for. The same thing with Wisconsin in the opposite direction. I think it leans a little bit more Republican. The fact that Evers is in there, the fact that Evers, I think, won, it's been called for him, right? And some of the vote share that turned out is quite significant. I think that you got to pay attention to that when you're looking at how some of these vote breaks moved. I think you're going to see some analysis in the next couple of days that showed independents broke heavily towards the Democrats. Based probably on abortion and Republican extremism. I've talked about that on this show a lot, is the one fundamental metric that nobody has been talking about, nobody except for us, was which party is viewed as the most extreme. And Republicans were in a +8 position on that, even as the party out of power. That's very, very significant in an era of negative partisanship. Hasn't been talked about enough. Explains a lot of voting patterns over the last 30 years. Last night is just the latest chapter in a long ongoing saga proving that point to be true. Arizona is going to give us a little bit of jitters just because it's such a crazy redneck state down there. No offense to rednecks, Chuck, but that's the challenge. I think that's what we're going to see is how much they're going to push the envelope with the vote counting centers down there when they've got a crazy like Carrie Lake saying the election is being stolen from me every day. I think the margin is too big for her to overcome. I think that the Democrats are in a strong position in Arizona. And I think that as exciting as the night seemed to be, and this seemed like a relatively exciting midterm election, when we look back at this in 3 or 4 days, we're basically going to be like, you know what? The polling and the map and the averages were basically dead on.
Yeah, I think that you're right. To recap for our listeners, Arizona, as recording this morning, now there'll be a ballot drop Wednesday today, another ballot drop on Thursday. So by Friday morning, by the time you're hearing this, we'll probably have a winner there. Right now, Kelly is up about 113,000 votes. For those of you listening at home who remember Joe Biden being up in that state, and then that tightening down to less than 10,000 votes, you should know that Biden's lead 2 years ago was 90,000 votes. So Kelly now is at 113,000. So he's overperforming the Biden number. But again, different turnouts, right? Different election year. So also last night, Colorado Senate race, Latinos played a big, we're going to talk about Colorado a little bit, but Colorado, if you want to talk about how Florida is now a solid red state and not a marginal state anymore, then we have to talk about Colorado probably being a safely blue seat and not really in contention like Republicans tried to make us believe that it was. It's just trending the opposite way of Florida. But and also Latinos in Colorado are performing way better than they are in a lot of other states. They may, and when we get to the congressional race, we talked a lot about Colorado 8, a race that's 50-50 on the books. And I didn't really think we had a shot in that seat in an off year with all the headwinds. But Yadira, the doctor who's running there, we're going to get to that, is up by 3,500 votes. It's probably going to be a new Latina Democratic congresswoman in a 50-50 seat in Colorado 8. But let me go on. Florida last night, Rubio wins. Big night for Republicans. Georgia, I covered. Oh, Iowa. Grassley wins. In Nevada, we talked about. Oh, in New Hampshire. We talked about New Hampshire a little bit, that the Republicans thought there could be something going on there. And Democrats even moved some late money, but that ended up being a wash. North Carolina, which we talked about last week, it was way closer than I think people realized. The African-American judge there, Miss Beasley, is currently at 1.7 million. And Bud, the winner, is at 1.9 million. So only 100,000 votes difference as we're talking about, but it's been called for Bud. And then the Ohio Senate race. I don't know if you watched the news this morning, Madrid, but obviously Ryan lost, and J.D. Vance is going to be the next congressman. I mean, the senator from Ohio. But if you watched Ryan's speech last night, he made it a point to say, in democracies, I'm proud to say that we left it on the field, but I lost. I'm not challenging any election results. This is the way democracy is supposed to work. And I want to make sure that I've already called and congratulated J.D. Watts, because we are not in this country going to be questioning fair elections. And so I thought that was a big deal.
Yeah.
And then the last two were Washington states, where people thought that Senator Murray was in trouble. She spanked this woman named Smiley, who everybody thought was going to be the future of the Republican Party up there. And then Wisconsin, which we talked about. Before I go to the governors, any of these Senate races that I mentioned, Colorado, Washington State, Utah, or any of these other ones that we haven't talked about on the show, Mike?
No, I mean, I think Colorado, you make a very good point. I think it is a much bluer state, the fundamentals. Every once in a while, a Republican will kind of eke something out in a weird situation. Colorado has been a state in transition for a very long time, and I think it's a much bluer state than most people realize. I agree with you there. Ohio, I think, is just you had a great candidate in Vance. You had a very poor candidate in Vance, a great candidate in Ryan. In a relatively good year for Democrats, Ohio is just not winnable anymore for Democrats. It's just not. And so we need to get past this idea that Florida and Ohio, which have always been the linchpin states in my adult life, are that way. I was making the case in 2020 they were not. I was saying, let's go to Arizona and Georgia on the Lincoln Project. That's what we did. Florida is a red state. It is not a purple state anymore. It is a red state. Ohio is a red state. Colorado is a blue state. So these states are shifting. They are solidifying, and we've got to start paying attention to the map, because North Carolina, I believe I wrote this to my political director from last cycle this morning, I think North Carolina becomes an extremely important state in the 270 map in 2024. Don't want to get down into 2024 discussion yet when the dust hasn't settled on 2022, but the map to 270 is very different than it was in 2020. You got to take Florida out of the mix. You got to take Ohio out of the mix. You got to put Arizona and Georgia into the mix, and I think that that makes increasing importance on three key states, Wisconsin, North Carolina, and New Hampshire. Those three states are going to be extraordinarily important. The map is expanding for 270. It's a bigger map, and it's with smaller states. That means the combination is going to get harder. Nevada, of course, you got to throw in there as well. All of these electoral college states with less than 10 votes, you got to pick up three out of five of them now, as opposed to winning the mother load of Florida or Ohio and putting it over the top. Anyway, I'm digressing and getting ahead of myself. But I am excited about some of the changes that we're seeing, because, again, this podcast is only going to become more necessary as we're talking about these Latino voters in that 270 map. A lot of Latino voters in North Carolina. It's going to be a significant voting block. The fact that it is this competitive, when we do the analysis and look back at this close, close race, much closer than I guess people expected, although the data was always telling us that Beasley was in this race and it was going to be close. You're not seeing Latinos in the polling in that state because the subsample is too small. But if it's breaking along a 70-30 range or even a 60-40 range, it will explain a lot as to why the Democrats getting more competitive and will continue to. I think you could say the same thing for Pennsylvania. And I think you could say the same thing in Wisconsin, where, again, there's more Latino votes than Black votes. It's the map is changing. The country is changing. The vote is changing. And I love being at the forefront of discussing all this stuff.
Before we go to the governors, and I'm going to go to it, I want to talk about the Senate race in Pennsylvania. And once we're on that, and y'all should know that I worked for the nation's largest Democratic super PAC on that race, the Senate Majority PAC, who does amazing work and is probably, I think, doing the best bilingual communications out there. And I think that their really intentionality around reaching Black and brown voters, because they had a separate operation reaching Black voters, which I thought was phenomenal as well. And I was telling Mike before we went on the air, I remember when the Phillies made the World Series, and I know the Latino vote in Pennsylvania, as me and Mike's talked about, I lived in Pittsburgh for 12 years. My son still lives in Pennsylvania. He was one of the votes for Fetterman last night. Most importantly, my twin 6-year-old grandsons live in Pennsylvania, who are my heart and soul. But when I saw the Phillies make the World Series, and it was the last 8 days of the election, Mike, I remember the meeting when I was like, there is a Spanish radio broadcast of the Phillies game every night. that Puerto Ricans, and y'all should know, and we've talked about this, 80% of the Latino population in Pennsylvania is Puerto Rican. They mainly live in Easton, Bethlehem, Allentown, in that eastern suburbs of Philly. So guess who they started following when they got there from the island and from New Jersey is their Phillies fans. And they over-index listening to baseball in Spanish because guess what they grew up doing in Puerto Rico? Listening to baseball in Spanish. So it was very, very expensive. And I remember having to have a conversation about how expensive it was and is it worth it? Back to our conversation, girls and boys, about why it's important to have a Latino or somebody in the room, because I got to make the argument. I went toe to toe. There was no ugliness. They totally agreed with me, but I got to make the point, no matter how expensive it was, even if we just ran one ad because it was that expensive, we had to be on the air every night that that was on the air through the end of the World Series, no matter what it was. And so I think that does the Chuck Rocha World Series make the difference? No. But you know as well as I do that it helped. And there's an estimation that there were a couple hundred thousand Latinos in Pennsylvania that voted for John Fetterman. And our numbers internally that I can talk about now had us almost at 70%, Mike. We were at 69. Now, the reason we were at 70%, just so y'all know, and me and Mike just talked about this, is because I didn't have any competition in Spanish. The Republicans who talk about going in and running these big Latino operations did not spend a dollar in Spanish. And so I had the Spanish language, a World Series baseball game all to myself, Mike. Now, they had all the English language bought and they spent a ton on English, but they were not competing with us because they didn't think the vote was worth it in that state. Am I saying anything to you that piques any interest?
I'm saying that that's really, really smart tactics, and it's why having a Latino at the table really matters. I think that I've seen too many meetings like that where it might be brought up by somebody, but it gets glossed over by putting it the rest of that money and doubling, tripling down on HGTV or the Hallmark Channel instead of going on Spanish language. The fact that there is a Chuck Rocha at the table is what makes the difference. And the fact that you are playing in an open field without competition absolutely makes a difference. Was it what put you over the top? No. Did it increase the margins? Yes. We can have a debate all day long, but when you're looking at a race as competitive as this one was, you want to move the needle where you can. You take those opportunities. You don't worry about how expensive it is. If somebody is going to cede the battlefield to you, then, you know, saddle up, move to the right flank or the left flank and start pushing the line. And it sounds like that's what you did. I love the 70-30 number that you're talking about. That's increasingly going to be that 30% magic number is what I was talking about the day of election. That's the old baseline standard, okay? That old 30%, that used to be the number that you were looking for. If Republicans were breaking into the 30% number, then a Democrat was starting to get into trouble. The fact that you're in Pennsylvania and you're holding them down at 30% explains in part why you can get to a Fetterman call the night of the election. And again, that's very significant. I want to drive that home. Remember, it took a good week to get Biden's numbers in there. The fact that people were comfortable making a Fetterman call the night of the election is important. Now, if you had Hispanic voters getting to the national baseline of 38, 39, 40%, which is what the exit polling was suggesting, could have been a longer night, could have been a longer call. Question becomes, are they getting the turnout that they need from those collar counties surrounding Philadelphia? Were they getting that Spanish language voter from the urban core in Philly? Probably not. And that's what the difference is going to be in these elections in non-traditional Latino states. So kudos to you. Smart, smart tactics shows that it makes a difference, shows that representation matters, and it shows that smart campaigns make the needle move enough to put some of these key Senate races and governor's races and House races into play.
Big night in the governor's races. We're going to go through those really quickly. I'm not going to talk about the safe ones, but there was a tale of two stories last night. Again, there is a story about Florida. There's a story about Ron DeSantis, and there's a story about Donald Trump here. I think that what we haven't talked about, and I want Mike to give me his input on that after I go through a couple of these, is I think Donald Trump had a big impact on these elections last night with the candidates that he handpicked in the Senate and in these governor's races. Now, with Ron DeSantis, who won, and let me say as a Democrat, won overwhelmingly. And let me say, as a Democrat, flip Miami-Dade for the first time in the history to the Democratic column in a long time. So I want Mike to tell us about Florida when we come back to Mike's reaction on those. But Florida's there. Ron DeSantis wins by over 1.5 million votes. Also last night, the Arizona race, where you heard us talk about the Masters number. Well, guess what? The Democrat is ahead today in Arizona, but only by about, let's see here, 12,000 votes. That's 100,000 votes less than the Senate race. That's how much of a drop-off you have between these two people. So that could go a much different way by the time you're listening to this. But the day after the election, the Democrat Hobbs over Kerry Lake's only up 10,000 real quick. Mike is definitely going to talk about the governor's race in Georgia, which he called probably starting 3 months ago when he said that Kemp was going to win that and that Stacey Abrams was going to lose. I give Mike Madrid a lot of shit when he's wrong, but I also have to recognize when Mike Madrid is right, and he was right about the Georgia governor's race. He called it all along. And then just a couple other notes for history for y'all. Last night in Maryland, the Democrats flipped a governor's race from Republican to Democrat and elected the first black man ever to be the governor of Maryland. He's a friend of mine, Wes Moore. He's also an Army veteran. He's going to be a great governor and an up-and-comer. Keep an eye on this guy. Young, amazing, Army. I don't know if it's Army. Armed Forces. Just all of the things that you look for. And I don't want to say it out loud, but I'll say like a young Barack Obama. Like, he's got a lot of potential, this guy. Last night in Massachusetts, they elected their first ever woman governor. Take that. And then probably the two that are the bit craziest is if Florida was such a big thing for Republicans, then Democrats secured the blue wall. The blue wall is Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin. They elected Democratic governors in all three of the states that Trump won in 16. And they kept the blue wall in all three of those. After Mike gives us his input, I'm going to give y'all a story about the secret work that we did also, Mike, that I never talked about in Michigan for the governor and the down ballot races. And then lastly, Michelle Lujan Grisham gets reelected in New Mexico, the only Latina governor. And then, oh my God, Nevada. So you remember the number we talked about in Nevada? Well, the governor Sisolak in Nevada is behind by 40,000 votes. That's twice as many as CCM is behind. So there's another drop off there. So it's just something to look at. Mike, tell me what you thought about these governor's races. And please, for our start with your my favorite, which is the DeSantis Trump stuff in Florida.
Boy, this is a huge narrative coming out of the national storyline. I think it's being swamped because the shock and overperformance of Democrats beat expectations. But it's very significant. The first is, this is one state where the polling was wrong. The average had DeSantis at about a plus 13 position. He's going to end up plus 20. Okay, Ron DeSantis is going to win bigger in Florida than Gavin Newsom is going to win in California. Maybe by a sizable margin. I can't underscore enough. This was a complete ass kicking. The one Republican ass kicking that they got, it came in the form of Governor Ron DeSantis. Now, as you mentioned, Miami-Dade goes Republican for the first time. This consolidation of Cuban voters under the Republican banner is extremely real. It's extremely big, and it's affecting Florida politics. But, and this is an important but, it also appears that the Republican won the Puerto Rican vote, largely along the I-5 corridor. Yeah, yeah, got your attention there, didn't I? And it also appears that they were making—
like, what did he say?
Yeah, it also appears that the Republicans were getting a very, very significant share of the Mexican-American vote, probably won the Venezuelan vote, and the mishmash of Central and South American diasporas there that make up Florida. So the beating was thorough, it was complete, it was deep, and it was wide. And the question then becomes, does DeSantis become a national figure at a time when Donald Trump is clearly seeing his own weaknesses exposed on the national stage? DeSantis is going to try to make the case that his Hispanic numbers make him a national figure at a time when Donald Trump has got the knives out and is going to announce in the next couple of weeks but is severely weakened in the Republican Party. DeSantis's hand is significantly strengthened. I still believe DeSantis blinks. I don't think he's got the guts. I don't think he's got the nerve. I don't think he's got the balls to take on Donald Trump. And I think he's going to, you know, sit this one out. But he does have a national narrative that he can command, and it is something that is stronger than I thought it was, because I thought it would just, yeah, he'd win overwhelmingly with Cubans and Venezuelans, but he would not do as well with Puerto Ricans and with Mexican Americans. That does not seem to be the case. That combined with this new 40% baseline Hispanic vote nationally for Republicans means that a lot of these states are more contentious than otherwise would be the case. So look for the internecine warfare between DeSantis and Trump in the next 7 to 10 days. It's going to get serious. It's going to get mean. It's going to get ugly. It's going to get nasty. Trump has already said he's going to be leaking some very damaging personal information on DeSantis. The New York Times ran a story on what it was. We're not going to get into exactly what that is, but it's pretty salacious stuff. So it's begun. The cats are out. They're scratching each other's eyeballs. That takes us over to two other states that you just mentioned, where there seems to be some split ticketing going on. Arizona, big gap, as you mentioned, between the U.S. Senate race and the governor's race there. It looks like Kelly is a much, much stronger position, probably going to bring that home over Blake Masters. Hobbs is much, much closer. It's like a 12,000-15,000 vote differential. I don't know if that's going to be enough. I don't know if there's enough legs there. I feel confident saying Kelly wins that race. Not very confident calling it for Hobbs quite yet. We'll probably know a lot more by the time this airs on Thursday, Friday morning. And then Nevada, again, this split between Sisolak and CCM. Catherine Cortez Masto seems to be outperforming. We're going to see where that Hispanic break comes out in Clark County. We're going to see if the mail ballots are there enough to keep her career going and keep her alive and breathing. Not sure it's going to be enough to bring Sisolak home, but things feel much better in the CCM race than it otherwise would. Sorry, I'm just going through so much right now. I always have trouble with Cortez Masto's name. I don't know why. But I think that you're going to see some split ticketing. I think you're going to see some party members from different governor's mansions and different parties in U.S. Senate races this year. That's unique, or at least it's very atypical. But that's where I see the governor's races coming down. You see, Pennsylvania, this wide, again, both Democrats did very well in Pennsylvania, but Shapiro just commanding victory. Go ahead.
I just think that there's a through line here, Mike, that you didn't touch on that I want to bring up so I don't forget it. And that is, the reason that he did better is that he was running against a guy that was at the January 6th insurrection.
Yeah, that helps.
Right. And so there's a lot of crazy candidates that Trump backed who are dragging the ticket down with them. Like, you could say Oz. Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, no, you're right. That was a through line I did not touch. These Trumpy candidates were not helping, possible exception of Carrie Lake. But look, he picked election deniers. He went with celebrity over substance. And in most of these instances, he's lost and he's losing. Trump had a bad night. Okay, Trump proved that his candidates do not move independents. They don't carry over with independents. It's demonstrable. It's evidence-based. There is teeth gnashing going on in the political consulting class, to which I say, you know what? Screw you guys, because you've known this for years and you allowed it and you enabled it, and there's no tears shed for you. All of these, tweets that the reporters were putting out saying Republicans are pissed and the political consultants are pissed. Yeah, well, they could have done something about it and they didn't. So too damn bad for you. You guys deserve it. A lot of us stood up years ago. You should have done the same damn thing. You're getting your just desserts now. But Trumpism is not a winning ticket. It's not looking good. And I think that the Republicans, it's undeniable now, and we're going to see Fox News is already moving on from Trump and pushing DeSantis more. I think this is going to be a bloody, bloody fight, because Donald Trump is a unique character in the Republican Party machinery. It's not like a Clinton. It's not like an Obama, where they're just going to move on to the next one. This guy is their orange god and savior, and they will go down with the ship. At least 25 or 30% of them absolutely will, regardless. And that means the Republicans can't win with Trump, and they can't win without him.
So as we wrap up the governor's conversation, I think it's important, this is the Latino Vote podcast, that we spend just a minute talking about and letting you know that Greg Abbott will be the governor of Texas again, and that he got this morning over 800,000 more votes than Beto did. It's this morning, again, Wednesday morning, Abbott's at 53, Beto's at 45. I think if when we get to the congressional races, Mike, and we talk about these Texas Valley races meeting their expectations again, I think Beto had a lot to do with that. I think Beto ran a good campaign. He went and talked in Republican areas. He went and challenged Abbott. It's just, we're just, y'all, a few cycles away from somebody like Beto being able to do something in Texas if the Democrats do their job there. If they just think it's going to, these Latinos are going to turn Democrat because they're young, they're not. But we can spend some resources there. But our friend Beto lost that race. Also in Pennsylvania, to draw a difference between the Senate and the governor's race, Mike, our internals had like Shapiro, Republicans, Latinos only at like 25. Like they couldn't even get to 30 with Shapiro, right? And Shapiro got about 500,000 more votes than Fetterman did as of this morning. 500,000 more. That's the off vote between the two. Mm-hmm. Also, there had been some talk about Oregon because there's a third party candidate in Oregon. You've probably already been talking about that, but the Democrats ahead there, but just by a couple thousand votes, and they're still 30% outstanding there. And also this New York race, I want to mention this because it dovetails into the House races, which we're going to get into next. Because this guy, Zeldin, overperformed as a Republican in New York. Now, he got beat handily by Hochul. It was 52-47 as of this morning with 92% in. But oh my God, statewide, and when I start talking to you about some of these congressional races in New York City that are overperforming for Republicans, it's because this guy at the top was driving the outreach there, and it did have a dramatic effect on the House races. And I think the only other governor's race is, I want to talk about Michigan, Wisconsin for just a minute. Look, if we're going to win the presidency, the Democrats, we have to carry the three blue states again. Well, it really helps when you have a governor there, and you're probably going to have, and we'll get to this in just a second, a Republican majority in the House that just has a small majority that Mike Madrid has taught me is really good for Democrats. And in Michigan, they put choice on the ballot, and they had, again, a Donald Trump MAGA Republican woman running, and that coupled with groups on the ground like Progress Michigan and the Table for Progressives and Democrats, they're running a great operation. And full disclosure, we're really honored to get to do all the bilingual and Spanish language communications for that table that started months in advance. Spanish radio, Spanish digital, Spanish newspaper ads. Those are the stories that go unreported of all the work that was done on the ground. I'm really proud of me and my team. Again, hat tip to my team who does all the work for doing Spanish language. And again, I was in the meeting when they were like, well, what do you think? I was like, well, we should really think about doing some Spanish language newspapers because it's really cheap. It don't cost that much. We can do it for a long period of time. And then couple that with digital and radio, because for those of you who don't know, there's not a big Spanish language TV station in Detroit or Michigan. So the Latinos had an over effect in these blue wall states, in the governor's races in Wisconsin, Michigan, in Pennsylvania. And that is an underreported story today, but it's super important as we look towards 24, because these states will again be really, really important. Mike, let's get to the House races.
Can I throw in one other race to take a quick look at too? Shabaka is going to beat Murkowski in Alaska.
Star Wars Chewbacca?
Yeah,
that's a different thing.
It's a different thing, but it looks like ranked choice voting may actually undo the Murkowski independent campaign there. I don't know. I mean, Sarah Palin has shown she can lose 2 times in 3 months. Lauren Boebert looks like she's going to lose
the House, right?
That's the House seat, but Shabaka Murkowski is the Senate seat, right? And that could be the balance of power. That could be that if it's a 50-50 going into Alaska, that might be the sleeper race that nobody was really paying a whole lot of attention to because it's such an anomaly, one being Alaska, two, it's Murkowski.
Oh, you mean the governor?
Is that the governor's race?
Yeah, but the governor's race in Alaska, just so I have somebody named Dunleavy, who is a Republican incumbent.
On site? I'm sorry. Yeah, no, that's right. What I'm also looking at is...
We're both on our computer, so y'all know. We're making sure we have the names right. In these races,
Incidentally, I mean, Ross Johnson just canceled his acceptance speech in Wisconsin.
Ron Johnson?
Yeah. Did he? It may be getting tightened up there.
Good. Yeah, I'm hoping. I think that that's right. I was waiting to talk about that operation until we actually could maybe win it. But there was some really crazy good work done there by lingering, talking to folks.
Yeah, I'm talking about the Senate the Senate race with Shabaka and Murkowski and Chesbro. There's two Republicans there, essentially, Shabaka and Murkowski, that were running, splitting the vote up in Chesbro. They've got ranked choice voting there in Alaska, so we're not going to know exactly how this comes out, but Shabaka looks like she's...
She's ahead.
Yeah, and it's tight. It's close. Don't get me wrong. This could switch. This could change. But you know, when we're getting down to 50-50 Senate and runoffs in Georgia with Warnock.
But wait, Mike, aren't they both Republicans?
They are, but it's a ranked choice voting there. So that's what we're looking at. Mm. Which may be the future, by the way, of voting in a lot of states. I think you're going to start seeing that come online a little bit more. Anyway,
sorry about that. I was making sure that we didn't elect a big hairy animal from Star Wars to the U.S. Senate is all I was really worried about there at that point. I didn't want Chewbacca. But anyway, I digress. So let's talk about the House real quick.
The House. Yep.
Not real quick. It'll take us a minute. But look, first of all, let's talk about how brilliant Chuck Roche is, because this is my favorite subject about how smart I am. And I told folks, Mike, last, if you remember, if you look at these three congressional races in Virginia, early on in the night, it will tell you. And I said, Lori, who is in Virginia too, is an R plus two seat. If she loses, no big deal. It's an R seat by two. Okay. It still could be an okay night. Then we move over to Virginia 10. And guess what? In Virginia 2, the Democrat lost. Then we go to Virginia 10, which is a D plus two seat, running against a Latina. Remember that seat, Mike? The El Salvadorian sheriff or whoever. But in a D plus two, and oh my God, up until the night, the Republican woman was ahead until like 10:30, 11 o'clock, and all of a sudden, right, Spanberger jumps ahead. And guess what? The Democrat wins. And when she won, all of us on our Latino, what I'd say group chat, 15 group chats we had going last night, we were all like, uh-oh, something good is happening. We just won a seat against a Latina in a D plus two. And then the Wexler seat right next door, which is a D plus six seat, we won easily. So I was like, oh, well, maybe this won't be. And it ended up being just what we started talking about, a really, really good night for Democrats. They met expectations as far as the Democratic performance, but hugely exceeded expectations with all of the headwinds, the economic environment, the inflation, the gas prices. We should not be in this game. Mike Madrid, who is a student of history, who's probably going to talk about seats that we lost in 2010 and probably go back all the way to 1994, if I know his old ass, and talk about history, right? And so when you talk about the history, we beat history last night, right, Mike?
Yeah, and that's why it was such a big night, is the Democrats beat some very, very significant headwinds. And like I think you said in the introduction, look, in the final analysis, this may be a Republican, you know, majority of 5 to 15 seats. You know, Chuck and I were both predicting it would be probably Republican plus 20 to 25 seats. And the Senate is going to come out the way we predicted it would likely be. And the governor's race is probably pretty close too. That means we basically predicted what was feeling like a very significant Republican year. The truth is, it feels very different because historically, the Democrats had no business being competitive in this election cycle, and yet here they were. So they're successful insofar as they held up to the actual map and the data, but the map and the data had no business being where it was given the historical trend lines. There's just no other way around it. So yeah, when you saw Spanberger win, it also took a lot of the narrative out of the Republican belief that there was going to be this Latina conference that was going to show up next January 6th and be sworn in with 6-7 new Hispanic women as part of the House GOP conference. They're not going to be there. Monica de la Cruz will be there, but Velas is gone. You're not going to have Myra Flores lost. The triple threat in the Rio Grande Valley never materialized. So the Hispanic women narrative that Republicans were hoping to really hang their hat on did not come to pass. There will be a couple of more, but it was the expectation was that it would be much, much more aggressive, much more significant victories, and start changing the entire narrative for the Republican Party. That's not the case.
So as we're having this conversation on Wednesday morning here at the Enclosed Latino Vote Podcast National Headquarters at a food court in Northwest DC, we want to let you know that a bunch of these races have not been called yet. So we don't know who's going to have control of Congress. If you were to take two old Mexicans and us put our head together and look at where the map is right now and who's leading certain races and what votes still out, my guesstimation is Republicans are going to win the majority, but they're only going to have a small group of seats that are giving them that majority, probably anywhere from 2 to maybe 6 is my guess. Mike, what's your guess?
I mean, I think that's probably right now. I thought it was really fascinating to hear Kevin McCarthy give this late speech last night saying when we wake up, we'll have a majority that will be bigger than what the Democrats' majority is. Well, the Democrats only have a 5-seat majority. That's not big. That's at the very, very low end of his expectation range. Look, Maloney losing in Long Island. A lot of these white Democrats lost on Long Island. Those New York seats are going to be very significant nationally. The other ones are going to be in California, which are going to take 3 weeks to count. David Valadao in California 22, the most Hispanic congressional district held by a Republican in California. Valadao, the Republican, is up by pretty strong numbers. Looks like he's going to be safe. Duarte, a Latino Republican in the north part of the Central Valley, running against Adam Gray, a conservative blue dog Democrat in the Central Valley of California, is up on Adam Gray. So there seems to be this Hispanic rightward shift, even in California. Caruso's numbers, the running for mayor of LA as the centrist Republican up until just a couple of months ago, seems to be performing pretty well with the Hispanic vote. It's one of his bases of support. There seems to be this centrism emerging with Hispanics and in these congressional races. If Mike Garcia, the Republican in the Santa Clarita Valley, holds on, you're going to see Republicans even in California saying, see, we can win the Hispanic vote here.
Let's go through a few of these and give our listeners an update on what we talked about the day before the election. The fact of the matter is, no matter which side you're on listening to this podcast, there's going to be more Latinos in Congress and Latinas than ever in the history of our country. Guess what, boys and girls? We're getting bigger. We're getting louder. There's more of us every election, and there'll be more brown people, Republican, mainly Democrats, and I'll get to that, in Congress than ever in the history of our caucus, in the history of our country. And it starts with folks that we elected last night that we know have been elected. There are five new Democratic Congress people that are coming to Congress no matter what, and I'm going to get to the others. The first is our favorite down in Orlando, Maxwell Frost. Next is somebody we haven't talked about, Mike Madrid, but I was reminded last night, Rob Menendez is coming to Congress, Bob's son. Also coming to Congress is Delia Ramirez in Chicago, Greg Kassar in Austin, and Robert Garcia. That's the five, right? So also last night, let's start now at the top of our list and work our way down from most Democratic to least somewhat, or Latinos that are running in places. There were four big races last night where the Democrats make up over 70% of the Latino population. Of those four seats, two of them went to Republicans. Two of them went to Democrats. Let's talk about the Republicans first. The first one is Florida 27, which is the Miami seat, South Beach, and the heart of Miami City. I think it actually represents South Beach and downtown. And Annette Tadeo lost that to a Republican who had been there already and had been redistricting, but it's a even seat, but Annette lost. So that was a loss for Democrats, but it wasn't a pickup of any kind, and a Latina stays in that seat. In the seat in Texas that Vicente left, that was redistricted and became more Republican, but still a swingy district, it's going to be an R+2. Monica de la Cruz, in fact, did win that. She's a very MAGA Republican, and she's going to be the congresswoman there and beat Michelle Viejo. But ironically, not by very much, Mike. And we'll have a whole other podcast about did it matter when the DCCC and others folks walked away from that race. I think my gut tells me if they would have played, that we could have won that, now that I see how well Democrats did overall in the Valley. And then Vicente and Henry Cuellar, who were on either side of the 15th district, both won. And guess what? They won by the margins that their house was drawn to be. Vicente probably underperformed the numbers some, but still wins by 4, 5, 6 points by the end. I think today it's 48-52. I think that number will grow a little bit, but that's underperforming a D+8 or 9 seat. Henry Cuellar is in a D+6 or 7 seat, and he knocked it out of the ballpark, and he met his numbers, right? So is there a slide in some of these? I think you're going to continue to see a little bit of a slide, a little bit here, a little bit there. We're going to be moving. We're a persuadable universe of voters who are wanting somebody to talk to us. And I'll stop there and let you react to those four before we go to the next grouping of those. But I think it's really ironic that I mention Monica de la Cruz and Maxwell Frost in the same sentence. Because
yeah,
that's going to be each end of what our constituent is.
And again, it's so reflective of what is happening in this country and the demographic change. It's important, as much as we get into the weeds, to step back and take a good look at what you just said. There's Monica de la Cruz, a MAGA Republican from the border communities of the Central Valley or Rio Grande Valley. And then you've got Malcolm Frost, Afro-Cuban Gen Z with an incredible life story, even as a very, very young man who's going to be redefining what the Cuban political experience is. It's going to make for an exciting Congress. It's going to make for a complex narrative about the Latino community, which we deserve because we are a complex, nuanced people. Having said that, every one of the seats that you mentioned became more Republican. It shifted more right with the exception of Cuellar. Cuellar moved those numbers considerably to the left, and he is one of the, if not the most moderate member of the Democratic caucus. You've got to pay attention to that in those communities. That's what works. That's what sells. And if you look at some of these districts that you're talking about, where some of these MAGA Latina extremists lost in heavily Latino precincts, it's also showing that Latinos are rejecting some of this extremism. So if you take the idea that Latinos got Cuellar into a winning position, strongest Democratic performance there as a moderate, the most moderate Democrat in the Democratic conference, and the fact that they were rejecting Latina extremism, MAGA, America First extremism, it portends very, very well for moderation in our body politic and will force both parties to come to the center, which is what Chuck and I have always been talking about. Chuck and I disagree on a lot, but we can always find some middle ground and enough to at least accept some arguments and move on to the next discussion point. That's the way it's supposed to work. That's what the hope is for the Latino vote for our democracy. I'll be talking a lot about that in the coming weeks and months and heading into the new year, because that really is the hope for where the American experiment can go at a time when, frankly, white people are tearing the Constitution to shreds and ripping the country apart. It may be brown people, maybe Latinos, who are actually the hope of this American experiment going on for the next generation, even though we have never fully had a seat at the table, we are still willing to fight for what it could be and the promise of what America could be. But keep in mind, so here's what I really want you to look for, not just when you hear this in the next 72 hours when this goes live, but over the next 3 or 4 weeks as more and more data comes in, is Latinos have a new national baseline of 38, 39, 40% of Republican support. If you would have told me this only 4 years ago, I would have laughed at you and said, that's absolutely not possible. The next question becomes, how does that happen when Democrats are picking up more seats and Republicans are losing, even though Republicans are winning more of the vote share? The answer is the margins are getting tighter. And these tighter margins in these districts portend well for moderate candidates. That's what I'm telling you. That's what's important. And if Latinos can redefine moderation in our political system, I think ultimately, Chuck, that's a very good, very healthy thing.
I'm going to hit on a couple. We're already going long here. We'll have another recording next week to go over when we have more final results. But let me hit a couple races where Latinos are going to be in Congress and did really well last night. So other new members. We've talked about the Southern District of New Mexico. It was redrawn to be more of a moderate seat, D+1. And my buddy Gabe Vasquez, who looks like is going to win, Mike, by about 900 votes.
Yeah, New Mexico too.
Yeah, it's really great. Gabe is a great guy, and I love him. And y'all should know that, again, we can talk about this now. I was honored to work with Equis and with a nonprofit on the ground. And Mike, we're going to be writing a paper about this, and we'll share it more broadly. But we spent $4.7 million on a canvas program targeting, get this, Mike, all Latinos, not Democrats, not Republicans, not persuasive. We went after everybody and ran a voter registration program and then inundated all Latinos in just Las Cruces County, Doña Ana County to be exact. We sent a mail. We did Spanish radio. We did bilingual comms. We did bilingual digital. We spent almost $5 million talking to every single Latino in Doña Ana County, and he wins by 900 votes. I can't wait to show y'all the case study that's done here on what was done over long. Now, was there lots of money spent by national DC groups and the DCCC and the candidate and BOPAC? Absolutely, and that mattered. But the work on the ground, just the canvas, let me start, and we'll have a whole podcast about this, but just the canvas, Mike, was a $3 million canvas.
I never heard of that before.
In Doña Ana County, in Las Cruces, and the working class neighborhood right outside of El Paso that falls into New Mexico. So this will be
an experiment. You guys must have known people by their first name and known what their dog's name were. My God, $3 million for a canvassing program in South rural, New Mexico. I never heard of that.
In rural New Mexico. Yeah, we wanted to prove that could happen, though we could go back and see what of it did work. And now we can section out the data that you will love to dig through, Mike, on how did the non-voters perform. Yeah. Did these infrequent voters actually show up, and did our program really matter, right? So we have things. That was the whole reason to do this program, was to see what was possible. So I'm excited to talk about what my team, and again, hat tip to Eckes, hat tip to the groups on the ground in New Mexico who did the bulk of the work, and we ran a lot of this program through the local groups on the ground. Also,
can I talk about New Mexico too real quick?
No, do it.
Well, one quick add here. New Mexico, too, as you mentioned, Gabe Vasquez is going to probably win that, the Democrat in that district. But here's the thing about New Mexico, too. Biden won that district by +5. Gabe Vasquez is going to win that by 900 votes. That's a 5-point shift, more Republican, and the Democrat's going to win. That's what I'm talking about with the nuances of this vote, and what is happening is all these turnout mechanisms that Chuck we're employing is obviously working. But in a year like this, Democrats can win, but the margins are getting tighter. And that's what you really need to look at, to look under the hood, to understand what change is happening, not just in the Rio Grande Valley, not just in Miami-Dade, but it's happening in New Mexico too. It's happening in the Central Valley of California, and it's probably happening a little bit in Colorado 8.
Yeah, and also remember, y'all, what Mike is comparing is a presidential turnout to an off-year turnout. So we knew what Mike was saying, that the turnout in this race is historically low. The reason we picked it, Mike, and you'll love this, and we picked another district that is looking like it's not working out, is California 22, because we wanted two districts that historically underperform with Latinos, that they just don't turn out, right? So we're going to have two different case studies that are going to tell us a lot about the electorate. So I knew you would appreciate, but know that.
I'm looking forward to that report.
Off-year turnout in these races are so much different than the Biden years. We feel like this race now will be much easier to win in a presidential year if turnout is the rate that it should be, hence how Biden had this district by, 4 or 5 points. Colorado 8, it looks like we may elect a Latina to the new seat in Colorado that I would have never dreamed could happen, because I was being told that it's a Republican wave and that everything's going to move 2 or 3 points. And in a district that's 50-50, Yadira couldn't win. She's 3,500 votes in the lead right now. So Democrats could pick up Colorado 8. And then, Mike, I'm going to touch my map here so I can tell you about these. It looks like the risk that the Democrats in Nevada took in shoring up all of their CDs and making them all more Republican so they could have four new, all Democrats, may end up working out. They're ahead in all three of those seats, but just by a little bit. Again, reminder, y'all, these will be better turnouts for a presidential. This is the worst it can be right now. Pretty much. I mean, anything could happen. But again, inflation, headwinds, gas prices, economy, and you still pick it up. Like I don't want to go through them all, but you should just know that like Dina Titus is up 1,000 votes. This other one, we're up 900 votes. This other one, we're up 1,000 votes. So it's little margins, but those are three seats in Nevada that are going to play a big part of this election. And then the last thing, and then I'll turn it back over to Mike to talk about California. But in California, there are a ton of seats that have not been called yet. We talked about California 22, which it looks like Valadao again he has been a nemesis to the Democrats. Latinos totally always underperform in this district, but it's more than just 22. There are, let me give you, Mike, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. There are 15 seats right now in California that have not been called. And as we're having this conversation on Wednesday, by the time you're hearing this on Friday, how many of these seats, Mike, if any, will be called by then? And do you think California is going to end up being the factor of who's going to control Congress?
Yeah, none of these seats will be called by the time people hear this. It's going to be 3 weeks at least, because we count. The thing about California is we allow you to vote in any possible way you could. You can vote by carrier pigeon or smoke signal if you want to in California. And so it takes us a long time to count. And that's the policy decision we made, is we want to make voting as accessible as possible. The trade-off is it's going to take longer to count the different methods that you can vote by. So LA County will be the longest. Mike Garcia will be the last seat that will be called, that Republican-held seat up in the northern part of LA County, very suburban. He seems to be in a pretty strong position right now, but a long, long way to go. The three Orange County seats that have people on the edge of their seats, Katie Porter running against Scott Baugh, is actually running stronger than we would otherwise suggest or imagine right now. They're in Orange County. Orange County will come in a little bit earlier. Valadao, I think we'll know even sooner, because it's up in the Kern County area of the Central Valley. So we will know a couple of these seats, maybe, but probably not by the time people are hearing this. But the final, and it's going to, California, a lot of these seats are going to be determinative, because the balance of power is going to be so thin in the House. California actually will determine a significant size of the margin, especially if we're talking a 5-8 seat majority in either direction. Mike Garcia will be the last seat called in Los Angeles County. The three Orange County seats will be there. There's a North San Diego seat. There's two in the Central Valley that we're looking at. Never would have thought that it would come down to California, but here we are, and I expect it's going to be at least a few weeks out before we know what the actual numbers of the majority are either way.
So, boys and girls, thank you for listening, and I want to really say this beyond a shadow of a doubt, that I don't want to hear any more about giants or giants sleeping, because there's one thing that was proven last night, and that is the Latino vote is no sleeping giant. My God, we had our voice heard all over the country, whether it was Republicans in Florida, where Latinos overperform for Republicans, or in my opinion, in the other 49 states where Democrats exceeded expectations because of the margins of vote from Latinos in most of those cases. I think that they let their voice be heard, and that's what me and Mike Madrid have been talking about. We demand to have a place at the table, Democrats and Republicans. I'll make the argument about why they should be with us, and I can let Mike make the argument about why they should be there. But there's something that's beyond a shadow of a doubt, and that is that our community stood up last night and was heard when folks were saying, oh, we're running to the right, or oh, we're all to the left, or oh, we're not going to turn out. All that was bullshit. We were seen last night, and I really, really want to appreciate everybody. Mike, do you have any parting words?
No, I love what you just said. We're going to have to joint tweet that out together. This is the last time we should ever use the term sleeping giant. There's a new era has opened up in 2022. It has been a hell of a ride. Chuck, I've loved being your co-pilot on this podcast. We've had some amazing guests, some fantastic data, some really phenomenal findings. The timing couldn't be better. And folks who have been with us on the journey as our Patreon subscribers, getting some of that even grittier under the hood details, thank you for being supportive. All I can say is the next election cycle is going to get even better. There's just more and more to come. Fantastic interviews, new members of Congress, new senators to talk to, new political consultants. It's going to be a wild ride, and we just love, love, love doing what we're doing, and thanks for your support.
Probably between now and the time we put out the next episode, we'll do some Patreons from our house, from our phone. So be making sure that you're a Patreon subscriber, because we're going to be individually doing some of those, talking about individual races. Like, I'll probably do some deep dives into these Texas and New Mexico races, while Mike may talk about some of these congressional races in California. So be a Patreon subscriber. And also something we don't do enough on this program, and that is to recognize the folks behind my beautiful buttery sound and the folks behind the cameras. You know, our producers and executive producers, Bakari and Antonio and Kenna, you know, our team is a really special team. And what we don't say enough is that our team is 100% people of color, working class folks who are making a podcast with me and Mike Madrid. They put in the hard work. They do the work out there every day. And they're also from our community here in DC and out in California. So I want to recognize our production teams who make us look really good every day, which is obviously really hard to do with Mike Madrid, but kind of easy with my pretty face. But again, thank you for joining the Latino Vote podcast. Make sure you tune in. Make sure that you subscribe. Make sure that you share with your friends. Give us that 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. Be a Patreon member. And until next week, hit me and Mike Madrid up on the Twitters, and we'll see you soon.